Local news, culture, and NPR.
For Radio Catskill, this is Rosie Starr. Welcome to Farm and Country, locally produced radio about rural life in the Catskills and the Delaware River Valley. On today's show, Sweetwater Fishing Guide Evan Padua has a Hooked on Fishing report for the Upper Delaware River. Stephanie Phillips shares her conversation with Jessica Weiss, founder and executive director of Growing Soul. In her segment, Now You Know, you'll hear about this food waste program designed to remediate climate change through carbon sequestration. All of that and Keith Hubbard's Star Talk coming up on today's Farm and Country after news headlines from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Giles Snyder. Amid the Trump administration's deportation push, White House advisor Stephen Miller says the administration is considering a suspension of habeas corpus, the constitutional provision that gives people the right to challenge their detention in court.
The Constitution is clear, and that, of course, is the supreme law of the land, that the privilege of the writ of habeas corpus can be suspended in a time of invasion. So I would say that's an option we're actively looking at.
Miller, speaking to reporters yesterday, last night, a Tufts University doctoral student from Turkey was released from federal custody. A federal judge in Vermont ruled that Rumeysa Öztürk's detention by immigration officials appears to be unconstitutional. She'd been held at a detention facility in Louisiana for some 6 weeks. NPR has learned that the Trump administration is tightening its control of the agency responsible for regulating the country's nuclear reactors. NPR's Jeff Brumfield reports that sparked worries about safety.
Two U.S. officials told NPR that the White House is now reviewing all new regulations for nuclear reactors. That's a big departure for the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the famously tough and independent agency that's overseen nuclear safety in the U.S. since the 1970s. Former NRC Chair Allison McFarland says she's worried the changes could affect safety.
It's absolutely essential that the nuclear regulator be independent.
There may be more changes coming. NPR has seen a draft executive order that, if signed, would call on the NRC to rewrite nuclear safety rules and possibly loosen radiation standards for nuclear workers and the public. Jeff Brumfield, NPR News.
Residents of Atlanta got a jolt this morning. Many took to social media to post about feeling an earthquake. The U.S. Geological Survey says it struck about 160 miles north of Atlanta near Knoxville, Tennessee, with a magnitude of 4.1. Top leaders of Europe are in Ukraine's capital today to show a united front. NPR's Joannica Kisses reports from Kyiv that it's the first trip to Ukraine for Germany's newly appointed chancellor.
The leaders of France, Germany, Poland and the United Kingdom arrived in Kyiv by train and warmly embraced Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. French President Emmanuel Macron posted this video on social media showing the leaders lighting candles at a memorial for the war dead. The group is discussing proposals for a durable ceasefire. This meeting comes a day after the Kremlin welcomed its own allies to Moscow to mark the Soviet Union's role in defeating the Nazis during World War II. Ukraine celebrated Victory Day on May 8th with Europe to mark 80 years of the Allied victory against fascism. Joanna Kakissis, NPR News, Kyiv.
And from Washington, you're listening to NPR News.
We're rattling along with our songs about animals on the Wacko Little Monkeys with me, Graham Rice, here on Radio Catskill. And next week, I bring you songs about chickens, cows, pigs and sheep. So join me, please, for songs about farm animals on Sunday afternoon at 3.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Farm Arts Collective, located on Willow Wisp Organic Farm in Damascus, Pennsylvania. Farm Arts Collective's programs intersect the practices of farming, performance, food, and ecology. FarmArtsCollective.org. From the Community Foundation of Orange and Sullivan, a publicly supported philanthropic institution cfosny.org, and from listeners like you who donate at wjffradio.org.
Welcome back to Farm and Country. I'm your host, Rosie Starr. On today's show, Sweetwater fishing guide Evan Padua has a Hooked on Fishing report for the Upper Delaware River. Stephanie Phillips shares her conversation with Jessica Weiss, founder and executive director of Growing Soul. But first, here is Keith Hubbard with this week's Star Talk report. Thank you for joining us on Radio Catskill for this week's locally produced Farm and Country.
Country. I'm Keith Hubbard, and this is Star Talk. The five planets that have been known since antiquity, Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn, are named after Roman deities. When the sixth planet was discovered by William Herschel in 1781, a naming controversy ensued. Herschel wanted to name the planet Georgium Sidus, after King George III. Astronomers eventually decided to follow the convention of naming the planet after an ancient god. In classical mythology, Saturn was the father of Jupiter. This new planet sits farther out than Saturn, and so it was named after the father of Saturn, Uranus. The convention was followed again in 1846 and in 1930 with the discoveries of Neptune and Pluto, respectively. While the planets are named after Roman gods, the moons are named after the characters associated with the equivalent Greek gods of the planets. For example, the two moons of Mars, Phobos and Deimos, are named after the twin sons of the Greek gods Ares and Aphrodite. This is the naming convention for every planet but Uranus. The moons of Uranus are named after characters from works by Shakespeare and the poet Alexander Pope. Even the surface features on Uranus's moons are named after places in Shakespeare's works. The surface features on other bodies follow as strict a naming convention as the planets and moons. A feature may not bear the name of a living person or of a political or religious figure from the last 200 years. If you have any questions, comments, or ideas for future Star Talk segments, my email address is startalk@farmandcountry.org. For Farm and Country and Star Talk, this has been Keith Hubbard, reminding you to keep looking up.
Well, I was standing in that river with water to my knees. Sea shadow moving in a pool beneath those trees. Staying near till the sun goes down, even if I freeze. Fishing, living, feeling free.
For Radio Catskill and Farm and Country, this is Evan Padua, bringing you Hooked on Fishing. Spring is in full swing on the Upper Delaware. Mayflies are hatching abundantly almost on a daily basis, as well as a lot of caddisflies. Dry fly fishing and nymphing have been productive on a daily basis. The American shad are up throughout the entire Delaware River. Anglers have been catching and targeting them throughout this spring season. The sizes are looking a little bit above average for the past few years, so get out there, swing a shad dart or shad fly in the main current of the river, close to the bottom, and you might catch a 5-pound roe shad. If you hook a buck shad, the male shad, they are more likely to jump. If you hook a roe shad, they will stay near the bottom and pull really hard and run upstream. They are ocean fish that swim in the river, so it is fun to fight a fish of that caliber in this type of water. Using light tackle with 6-pound test line or even 4-pound test line is often your best bet to maximize the amount of shad bites throughout a day of fishing. Positioning yourself at the bottom of a rapid is a good place to get shad while they school up before migrating upstream throughout a rapid. The March brown mayfly is starting to show up, which is we call the ribeye of flies on the Delaware. It is one of the biggest mayflies of the season, and when the trout eat them, they eat them aggressively. So tie on a big March brown parachute, lay it out there in some flat water, and see if a trout will eat your fly. When fishing the Upper Delaware River, be sure to follow all the rules and regulations if you plan on catching and harvesting fish. Also, practicing a ethical catch and release is recommended when trout fishing the Upper Delaware. For Radio Catskill, Farm and Country, and Hooked on Fishing, this has been Evan Padua, casting off.
The eagle flies, I hear it's cry, my brother in the air. Two of us are drifting down along the Delaware. Tide that binds us is that fishing hole we share. Fishing, living, feeling free. When I'm standing in that river with water to my knees, see shadow moving in a pool beneath those trees. Staying here till the sun goes down, even if I freeze. Fishing, living, feeling free. Fishing, living, feeling free. Yes, I was fishing, living, feeling free.
Good morning. This is Stephanie Phillips with Now You Know for Farm and Country. This morning, I have the pleasure of meeting with Jessica Weiss, founder and executive director of Growing Soul, an organization that focuses on food waste.
Hi, I'm Jessica Weiss. I moved to Sullivan County 3 years ago. Prior to that, I created a nonprofit around zero waste and composting for carbon sequestration to help remediate climate change and to create zero waste so that we were really aware of what true sustainability is. We worked for 14 years on the soil trails of the Underground Railroad, creating compost and growing food in it as a legacy project for our community, Sandy Spring, Maryland, that fed the enslaved on their way towards freedom. And we believe that food sovereignty is the most important freedom that you can have. We work to barrier-free to make sure that our neighbors supporting neighbors in need, regardless of what they look like or what they believe, because everybody deserves to eat and to eat healthfully.
Can you explain the food trails of the Underground Railroad? I hadn't heard about that.
In the 1850s, during the Civil War, Harriet Tubman was a very famous conductor of the Underground Railroad. And basically what they did is they moved the enslaved people off of plantations and they helped to bring them to freedom up in New York and up across to Canada. She was actually in Auburn, New York, is where she would end up bringing people. My kids went to school at a friend school in Sandy Spring, Maryland, and it's on 140 acres that has a hollowed out tree where they would literally put food so that the people had something to eat on their way towards Sandy Spring, which was the first fresh water when they'd be coming up through from the eastern shore. It's a Quaker community that's an activist community and very much about creating peace amongst neighbors.
Interesting. We're sitting here in the Cornell Cooperative Extension's building. What's your association with the Cornell Cooperative Extension?
In 2022, Narrowsburg received a grant from the Department of Environmental Conservation for a municipal food scrap reduction grant, and they got an anaerobic digester, which is basically a composting machine that creates fuel for like an electric vehicle that you can plug into a generator, as well as this liquid fertilizer, which we now refer to as second helpings, a growing food, so a grow solution. They didn't want to have it in Narrowsburg, and I wanted to have it, and I didn't have a place here or anything, and I was talking to Cornell because I was wanting to use their kitchen, And we started talking to Colleen, and we talked about this vision of what a real sustainable food system would look like. She talked to the powers that be, and they decided that they could move the digester, which you can kind of see in the little purple shipping container over that way. And then I started working with 4-H to develop this Earth Defenders program. And so now we go to the Grahamsville Fair for 4-H, and we're working with kids. It's just another program that, if you know, you can do cooking, you can raise a horse, you can be an Earth Defender. And we teach them all with the zero waste, rethinking waste as reallocating resources. And we teach them about the difference between biodegradable and non-biodegradable, and how you can still recycle non-biodegradables by either recycling them or repurposing them. We teach them how to make tote bags out of their t-shirts, because there's like crazy 85% of textiles every year wind up in a landfill. We're teaching them about saving their juice cups from schools. We realize that they go through 2,500 plastic juice cups that are not recyclable. We decided we would take them and try and build a greenhouse with them. And then, of course, we teach them composting and all the fine arts of the culinary arts as well.
That's wild.
So I was invited into one meeting at Cornell and immediately was talking about all the different stuff that we were doing. And there were a lot of people there who were interested in finding supportive partners.
Jessica, do you redistribute food from any grower who has a surplus, or only those who are members of a group?
That's a very good question. So we have our current resources. So, for instance, Cornell Cooperative in Orange, they have a gleaning program where they'll go to farms and they'll get their... This summer we had 5,000 pounds of surplus watermelon that came in, and I got it out through the community listserv, using one of the community listservs to find people. When we had 1,000 pounds of basil to get rid of, people came in and they had like the way you would have a lemonade stand on your corner, but they just had a free basil stand.
I keep thinking about how that basil must have smelled when you had it all together.
Oh, it was fantastic. I'd love having fresh herbs grow around, and that's kind of our plan. And our new kitchen space in Highland, we're going to build a kitchen garden. Again, if we have like fresh chicken, we can give that out. But the other thing is that if you go to the grocery store, to the deli counter, and you see like these big bowls of potato salad and macaroni salad and tabbouleh and chicken chopped liver, once it's out like that, they can't repack it the next day. If they have a 5-gallon bucket and they sell 3 gallons of it, but there's 2 gallons left, we can take that and just get volunteers together in a commercial kitchen. They're trained to how to scoop it up, put it into pint containers or quart containers, and we can get those to the hotels where people are staying, or we can gift those out through the pantries.
Are there kinds of food waste that simply can't be prevented?
Well, when we talk about rethinking waste as reallocating resources, anything that grows from the ground or comes from an animal needs to go into an animal or back into the ground. So if it can't be made for people to eat it, it can be given to farm animals. It could be baked up into biscuits for animals. If we can't even do that, the very least we do is we compost it, which is actually how to remediate climate change. So it's really kind of the best that we do, but we want to make sure that people and animals get fed in the process. Literally anything that grows from the ground, even if it's toxic, they now have these programs where they use turkey tail mushrooms. Cigarette butts can be devoured by these turkey tail mushrooms, the mycelial mats. It's crazy. So the ability to compost, whether it's anaerobically, which is what our digester does, without oxygen, or to do it on farmland, which is what people are more familiar with, and turn it and have it become soil. Anything that can grow from the ground or come from an animal can go back into the land.
This is an unusual program, it seems to me. Are there other programs like this?
There are definitely urban farm programs where they teach how to grow in containers instead of... We want people to know you don't need to have a backyard. If you have a windowsill, you could grow herbs on your thing. There are many programs that teach how to grow food. There are extension in general, wherever you are in extension. If you want to can peaches and you don't know how to do it, you call up extension and they help you to do that. There are places that compost, and there are pantries that do food recovery. But what our model does, I believe, that is unique is anybody who comes to our kitchen to make food can take food back with them or take some compost back with them. If you donate your food scraps to us, you're entitled to get a jar of second helping so that you can fertilize your plants with it. And on 97, where the anaerobic digester was originally in Narrowsburg, at the house where there's a solar array there, it's the highway building where they store trucks and things like that for the highway. There's a line of forsythia, 10 forsythia trees that were all bought at the same place, same time, planted at the same time. And when we had our first batch of the second helpings, we fertilized one side of the forsythia. And when it's great around this time of year, when the forsythia starts to bloom, you can see that one side is a little bit scraggly and it's kind of getting started, and the other side is just massively lush and in full bloom. That was our jump start to, oh my gosh, we can show this. And because we are granted through the Department of Environmental Conservation, we're working with the towns. We have a grant now with the Town of Liberty, and we want municipal buildings. Everybody should be using this, the liquid fertilizer. It also, with 4-H, that we're teaching people how to be worm farmers, how to grow worms. You know, the other day, we were doing our worm project, and our worms had, you know, we'd kind of let them go for the season. And so I needed to get worms, and I didn't have a farm or anything where I could dig for them, so I went to look for them at bait shops. And it's $6 for 12 earthworms.
Oh, my.
And like 50 cents a worm? And you need like 100 worms at least to start a worm bin. And it was like, we are worm wranglers. We're going to get the worms from the soil and be able to create that as a business. There are people out there that are willing to pay 50 cents for a worm. We can grow thousands and thousands of worms in a four-month period of time by feeding them food scraps and helping them to create the bacterial love that they need to do in order to create the fertile soil. And Barbara's fantastic about thinking about opportunities for kids that are not the standard ones that have been used for 4-H, but incorporating all aspects of this, like repurposing. You want to be the person who takes all the wine bottles and instead of recycling them, if you can't get your 5 cents back at the recycling center, taking little fairy lights and putting them in, and then they become like these bougie, put it at your nice dining room table, and a kid has been able to make it for less than $1 and be able to sell it for $20.
What do you do when your food is near the expiration date? How fast can you move things?
As a tribute to this summer, it was amazing. We have one farmer who was growing food just for donation, and in 1 month, we moved about 8,000 pounds of corn, tomatoes, peppers in 1 month.
Why was he growing food for donating?
Because he recognized that he wanted some tax deductions. I explained to him how the IRS enhanced tax deduction works, and he realized that he made more money by donating it than by selling it. And because he's just a good human being and wants to donate to the community, it was part of his mission, and able to get the children who were like interns and volunteers who wanted to spend their time training for their mission. They worked on the farm. And so it met his needs and it met our needs, and we got rid of it really, really fast. So there's a wonderful program in Sullivan County that takes place on Airport Road across from the airport. Sharon Ferber runs it from Social Services. It's like an airplane hangar that they clear out, and every pantry that's registered with the food bank gets a 4x4 foot pallet on the ground. So there's 13 to 20 of them spaced out, depending on who's coming that day. The regional food bank drives in with 8 to 12 pallets of food. Volunteers redistribute it equally onto the pallets, knowing which pallet goes to which pantry and how many people they're served. And then they throw up the garage doors, and the pantry drives through, and they load up their truck, and they drive off, and they do a pantry giveaway. So there's a wonderful centralized system for food donation to go out to the pantries. Again, there's a lot of people who are do-gooders, but they don't have a brick and mortar, so they're not allowed to technically be a pantry, so they're not affiliated with that particular giveaway. They can come to me, and I fill up their truck, and they bring it to their church, and it's redistributed that day at church. So that's what I'm trying to do, is we have 95
wow.
different kind of pantries that are official, and God only knows how many people are just willing to do this for the community, and that's why I was reaching out through the listserv, who's got friends in need. And it's a matter of integrity and dignity. We want people to eat, and we know people are proud and they don't want to necessarily take handouts. It's reciprocity. We're just neighbors helping our neighbors. It's like when you have all the zucchini and you have to hide it on your neighbor's porch because you can't get rid of it. That's how we want to make sure that it goes to not only people who need it, but people who will use it in the form that it's in. And if it's better to get something else, we want to get culturally appropriate foods for people. And if people, you know, have a heart condition or diabetes or whatever their health concerns are, we also want to be pointing them towards the foods that are less inflammatory and working with the hospitals to do that. So it's really just working inside of the community and finding out what people's needs are and having them open up about what their needs are. And that can be where the hardest work is. In the Highland Senior and Community Center, we're going to be serving community meals twice a month, where it's barrier-free. One will focus more on with kids there, but we think of all seniors we refer to as grand friends, because not everybody's a grandparent, but they're all grand friends. And to work together and just have opportunities to bring the community together. Ever since it's obviously harder in rural communities to get together, but it used to be, when I grew up, the neighborhood would have a party once a month, and all the parents would be out, and the kids would be playing, and it's just, for whatever reason, the lack of feeling a community and knowing that your neighbor's the barber and your other neighbor is the postmistress and you have each other's backs because your kids all go to school together, we want to generate that back.
I think we have a lot of that here to start with.
Yeah, which is great. And that's building that community. Actually, when I moved here after the pandemic, we'd fed 3 million people during the pandemic between West Virginia, Virginia, Maryland, D.C., and New York. And we were doing these huge food giveaways in Queens and Long Island, and we received a mayoral award. We were the only people who brought food to Staten Island. Poor Staten Island. We were the only people who brought them food. When I got up here and I was like pivoting, like people here probably don't, I don't know if they care about the Underground Railroad. It's like, what are we going to do? I'm not quite sure how to pivot. And I was at Bethel Woods and I didn't realize that this was a conservative farming community. And I'm like, oh my God, they must have been totally freaked out with all these colorful hippies hopping around. And as soon as they realized that there was no food, they made peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and they shared it out with these kids. That to me is the same spirit of the Underground Railroad. These hippie kids coming to set their souls free and seek freedom from the system, the man, whatever it was that they're seeking freedom for. And we are about freedom. And the idea of neighbors helping neighbors, regardless of what they look like or believe, because they're your neighbor, is what gives me great pleasure. I love to see community in creation.
So now you know some ways to avoid food waste in our neighborhoods. You heard about it from Jessica Weiss, founder and executive director of Growing Soul, a local organization that helps get excess food to where it is needed. This has been Stephanie Phillips for Farm and Country.
We hope that you enjoyed our show this week, with production by Radio Catskill volunteers Keith Hubbard, Evan Padua, and myself, Rosie Starr. Special thanks goes to our guest, Jessica Weiss, founder and executive director of Growing Soul. Thanks for listening local to Farm and Country and supporting Radio Catskill. Listen to us on air and on your smartphone. Stream us live with our webpage, wjffradio.org. We are Radio Catskill, local news, culture, conversations, and NPR.